We'll be talking about books, and over the years we've done this program where we've invited onto the show people who just either professionally they're involved with reading and publishing and library science, or maybe the thing is that they just are book lovers and they just love to read. And we've just said to them, well, why don't you come on and tell us about some books that you've come across lately that you just think were really good, that you enjoyed, that you could recommend to other people. And so that's what we do. And we'll be doing that this morning with four different guests. We have two guests in the first hour and two guests in the second. Also, as a way of encouraging people to support the station, we're doing, once again, what we have taken to call Crazy Dave and Jack and Harriet and Martha's big book giveaway. Here at the radio station, publishers send us many books. They're hoping that what we'll do is we'll interview the authors. And we do a lot of those. But there are far more than we can possibly do on this show. Staggering amounts. We get a big armloads of them every week. And some of them we do give away to folks here at the radio station. Some of them end up going to the University of Illinois Library. But occasionally, and yeah, Kelly, we'll talk about that later. Kelly Strom is here from the Champaign Library. She's giving me this, like, what am I, chopped liver kind of look. We can talk about that later. And also, we set aside a number of really good books to encourage people to make a contribution to the radio station. So I've been talking a long time here. I'm going to bring in my good friend, Crazy Jack.
Hello.
And you can describe, explain, talk about.
Disclaim.
Disclaim. How exactly does that? People say, Dave, how exactly can I get one of these books? Well, here's Jack to tell you how.
You can call our pledge line, 244-9455, right now. Make a pledge at our basic membership level, $40 for most people if you're a senior citizen, fixed income student, $25 or above. If you want to give us $1,000, that's okay, too. Either way, we will send you a book along with our thanks, either a fiction or nonfiction book. We have two categories. We have too many titles to list them. That gets too complicated. But if you're a fiction lover, then we'll send you a novel. If you want a nonfiction book, history, politics, health, environment, a variety of other sort of subgenres. But the main thing is if you want a nonfiction book, just tell the phone volunteer that with your pledge, and we will send you a book from the Focus 580 collection. And guaranteed, these are, you know, first published books, brand new hardcover books, a lot of really great books that we'd love to send on to you with our thanks.
All right. And also, we have a challenge we want to tell people about, too.
Absolutely right.
Go ahead and do that.
I will do that. Okay. Yeah. So, an anonymous donor wants to support Focus 580, wants 12 calls during Focus 580 this morning. I know we can do that between 10 and noon. This brand new Vision Circle donor really believes in the value of strong local programs, especially Focus 580. He listens to the show on his way to work every day. We know Focus has a strong following, but it doesn't tend to have all the fundraising fireworks of Morning Edition. So let's make that different today and have a blowout for Focus this morning. 12 calls between 10 and noon. An additional $1,000. That's quite generous. So we hope that you will help us meet that challenge and get a free book when you call with your pledge. 244-9455. Let me also mention the toll-free line.
Yes.
Again, which is area 866-779-9455. Or you can go online at willpledge.org, and there's a field there in the form to say fiction or nonfiction book. Make a pledge right now and help us out. Thanks.
Right, that's the deal. And here, if you would like to call in on the program, just to make it that much more confusing, let me give you another telephone number. It's the usual one that we use to call in on the show, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Because if you would like to recommend a book, you can do that. Making a pledge is not required. That would be nice, of course, but it is not required, so if you'd like to call in. So, have we started yet? Thanks very much, both of you, to being here. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Glad to be here.
Let me just introduce the guest, Kelly Strom. She is the collection manager at the Champaign Public Library, and her job, she is responsible for looking at all of the vast amount of stuff that is published and deciding what of that should be purchased and become part of the collection at the
Absolutely.
Library. That's right. And Stephen Lyons is here as well. He's writer and book reviewer. He's authored two books, View from the Inland Northwest and Landscape of the Heart. He also does reviews, and his reviews have appeared in a variety of places, including the Chicago Sun-Times, the San Francisco Chronicle, the Chicago Tribune, and other publications too numerous to mention. He is here for the – he's actually has hosted on the program and will be sitting in as a guest host sometime soon, end of the month.
On the 30th.
And so we're pleased to have you here to do this show. And Kelly has done this with us a couple times before, so really pleased to have you back. Well, now – who would like to start? Here the idea is what we say to the guest is, you know, just tell us about something recently that you've read that you thought is really good. I'll pick one. Kelly, go.
Well, I do have kind of a fun one to begin with. Okay. It's called The Boy Who Cried Freebird by Mitch Myers. And Mitch Myers is a music writer, and it says in the Publisher's Weekly review here that he's knowledgeable not only about rock, but also about blues, jazz, country, folk, metal, and electronic sounds, and he is also extremely funny. A potent combination that makes this collection of essays an insightful and entertaining look at popular music culture. So this is all these stories that he's written, kind of my urban legends. Yes, they relate to music.
Okay.
And the first one is about, you know, you go to some concerts and inevitably somebody in the audience, way in the back, all of a sudden at just the right time yells out, "Freebird!" Well, that's the story here about who is the person who's doing that and how he plans out which concerts he's going to go to and at the exact time that would be the right time.
So that's just one guy who's doing this.
That's what's in this legend here, right? And then there's another one that I wanted to read a little bit of. It's called Hellhound on My Trail. And it says, "It all started out innocently enough. I was trying to get some work done while listening to Robert Johnson, The Complete Recordings. To tell the truth, I was well into the second CD before I started writing. I'd been unproductive that day and spent hours on the phone before typing a single word. By the time I'd finally gotten to a decent work groove, the music on disc two had ended and I wrote in silence for about 20 minutes. I'd forgotten all about the music when suddenly Robert Johnson's blues-ridden wail started coming out of the speakers again. That's funny, I thought. The disc player isn't even on auto-repeat, and there aren't supposed to be any bonus cuts on this CD. I went into the living room and looked at the digital display on my disc player. The machine read track 30, but when I checked, the CD box only listed 21 tracks. The song ended, so I programmed the machine to play track 30 again. No such luck. The song seemed to have vanished. I examined the entire CD track by track, but it only went up to 21. I went backward and forward, but there was nothing else to be found. I even plugged the damn thing into my computer and read all the existing data. Still no go. Feeling confused, I called some people who I thought might have the Robert Johnson collection. After a few conversations, I found an old friend who owned the two-disc set. 'Have you listened to disc two all the way through?' I asked him. 'I think I've listened to it,' he said. 'Come on, Jim,' I pressed. 'You're no blues fanatic. Are you absolutely sure that you've listened to both CDs all the way through to the very end?' 'Well, actually,' Jim confessed, 'I only remember playing the song Crossroads to see how it compared with the version by Cream with Eric Clapton.' 'Well, don't put it on now,' I yelled. 'Just wait for me to get over to your place and I'll tell you all about it. I'll be there in 20 minutes. I hustled over to Jim's house and explained the situation. After telling him what happened, we agreed to play disc two in its entirety rather than searching for a phantom track. As a backup, I suggested that we use his old tape recorder to make a copy of the song if it appeared. According to plan, we sat through all 21 tracks on disc two and then turned on the tape recorder. Sure enough, the CD kept going rather than stopping after track 21. Exactly 16 minutes and 30 seconds later, track 30, the ghostly, angst-ridden blues that I'd heard in my apartment, was emanating from Jim's stereo. I must admit that I was a little freaked out. It was definitely Robert Johnson, but neither Jim nor I recognized the song, and it wasn't listed anywhere on the CD package. As I predicted, the song ended, and we couldn't get the disc to play track 30 again. Still, the meters on Jim's tape recorder had been moving while the tune played, so we were confident that we'd captured the elusive song. When we tried to play it back, the tape came up blank. Then Jim started to get nervous. 'I don't know, man,' he whined. 'It's just too weird, this whole legend about Robert Johnson having a hellhound on his trail and selling his soul to the devil at the crossroads. Think about it. The liner notes say that Johnson was only known to have recorded 29 compositions in his short life. The rest of the tracks on these two discs are just alternate versions of those same songs. 29 songs. Track 30? Come on. This one piece of unidentified music just happens to disappear from two different compact discs on two different stereos and can't be recorded onto tape. It's just too weird.'"
Okay. Sounds strange to me, but you never can tell.
It's a fun book. I think people should enjoy it.
All right. The Boy Who Cried Freebird. And also I want to mention to folks, you need not try to write down the titles and the authors here as we're doing this, assuming that you have computer and internet access, because we'll have all this on our website.
Mm-hmm.
So you can go back and check it out. And I'm sure then you can also go down to the library and harass the people down there and say, look, I heard Kelly
book.
On the show. She was talking about some Freebird thing. You know, do you have that book?
Yeah, no right. problem.
All right, very good. Well, see, that's the way we play this game, and we'll turn next to Stephen Lyons. Give us one.
Well, a book I reviewed recently for the Minneapolis Star Tribune is called The Immortalist, and it's written by a man named David Friedman. And it's an entertaining book of history, a little slice of history about Charles Lindbergh, and will do nothing really to enhance his status at all. But it's a fascinating book. He ends up getting paired with a eugenics a person, if you could say that, a 1912 Nobel Prize winner by the name of, and I've got it right here, Alex Carroll. And he worked out of Rockefeller University. And they got together and tried to elongate life, let's put it that way, through eugenics, through perfect breeding, if you will. And, of course, this comes right around the time of Hitler and Nazism. And, of course, if you know anything about Lindbergh, he is quite taken by Nazis and, again, did not help his legacy. And this book talks about this period of time where Charles Lindbergh and Alex Carroll get together and try to create the perfect human being, if you will. Mm-hmm. Their experiments at the Rockefeller Laboratory are quite gruesome, have to do with animals. It's nothing that would help. If PETA was around at the time, they'd be quite appalled, I would think. And it's just a wonderfully written piece of history. The two hit it off. They have great admiration for each other. And Lindbergh ends up working in the laboratory. He's sort of the mechanical engineer and creates many of these machines that are going to take human organs out and keep them going for years on end.
Hmm. Was this something that had previously fairly widely been known that Lindbergh was involved in this kind of thing?
I don't believe so. Of course, eugenics was very popular at the time. And Lindbergh had an about-face later when he entered Germany after the war and saw some of the concentration camps. And the odors that he smelled coming out of those camps were actually similar to what was going on in the Rockefeller Laboratory at the time. And then he had a complete about-face and realized probably too late for his legacy that what they were doing was probably wrong.
Hmm. Just, you know, something I'm curious about. When you end up reviewing a book, do you decide, I would like to review this book, and then you try to find some place to place it? Do you get, in a sense, do you get assigned by a particular publication? They say, we would like you to read this book and review it for us. How exactly does that work?
It's a mixed bag, David. Sometimes I can recommend a book to an editor, and they'll go for it. But oftentimes it's based on my interests, which are mainly nonfiction, narrative journalism, and some other interests within a nonfiction genre. And they will come to me with a book.
Yeah.
And that was the case with this one. I had no idea it was even on the radar screen. Yeah. And that's the wonderful thing about reviewing books is, besides getting the books every day at the house, it is the opportunity to read things that I had no idea existed.
Yeah. Well, that's, I think it's also, you're a part of what I take to be rather a dying breed, that is book reviewers. At least I think that now, it used to be that many newspapers had book reviewers on staff. They actually mm-hmm. worked for the newspaper. And that's one of the places that papers have found as they're trying to cut costs. There are a lot of places where they have dropped their book reviewers and it's being outsourced, essentially, if they want to have a review in there. There are reviews that they can get in the paper. But it seems that it's something that we're starting to see less and less of.
That's true. That's definitely true. The organization I belong to, the National Book Critics Circle, is trying to fight the good cause. But one of the best review sections in the country was just taken away, and that's the Atlanta Journal-Constitution got rid of their book review section. And all over the country, they are shrinking. What's interesting is that movie reviews seem to be on the rise. But if you think about it, there's more books produced every year than there are movies. But yet, give you an example, the News Gazette here in Champaign. They'll have review after review of movies in their Thursday section, and many times they're one- or two-starred reviews. But yet their book review section is this tiny little thing, one page on the Sunday, in the Sunday edition. I think that could be reversed easily because there's so much interest in books.
Yeah. Do you use reviews? Is that part of what you look at if you're trying to decide, am I going to buy a particular book for the library?
Absolutely. I look at reviews in both magazines, everyday magazines like Better Homes and Gardens, Parents, even Us Weekly, Newsweek. I also read newspaper reviews and some professional journals that just come to libraries or booksellers. And then I also just look at pop culture stuff. You know, I go to Amazon.com, see what the hot things are there, and if they're hot on Amazon, I want them at Champaign. You know, so I look at all kinds of things when I'm making selections like that.
Yeah. Well, that's really it's a tough for you because not only are you're going to be responsible for this very wide range of stuff, if the bestsellers have to be there. Absolutely. But there are also people who are going to come and say, you know, I heard about this book about Charles Lindbergh and eugenics. I want to read that. So you've really got to have a very wide sampling of stuff to account for the fact that you've got this big community and people have all kinds of different interests. And somehow, though, everybody expects the library to address those.
Yes, they do. And, you know, if we happen not to have the book that they're looking for, I haven't looked this particular one up. That Stephen was talking about, but if we don't have it, they can always request it, and I can either purchase it right off for them, or we can get it through interlibrary loan.
All right. Well, again, here on the program this morning is Stephen Lyons. He's a book reviewer and writer, and Kelly Strom. She's collection manager at the Champaign Public Library. It's the show that we do now and again when we have guests come on the show, and we just say, tell us about what you've read lately. Tell us about something that you really thought was a terrific read, a good book, you enjoyed it, or you just think that, you know, other people will, and tell us about that. And of course, people who are listening can do the same thing. Take another turn, Kelly.
Okay. Since Stephen has a lot of nonfiction, I thought I'd talk about a fiction piece I brought here. It's a book of short stories called The Dead Fish Museum, and it's by Charles D'Ambrosio. And I found it to be just a beautifully written collection here about the stories are not related to one another, so each story kind of brings you into another facet of someone's life and a chain of circumstances that bring them to the place that they are. And then just when this, you know, you're kind of absorbing that and getting used to it and thinking it through, the story ends. And then you move on to a different one. And sometimes it's a little unsettling because you're still really thinking about what happened in that last one. But on the other hand, I think it's a fabulous opportunity to see all the different types of lives that are going on in the world today. And I thought this was very good. There's one that I thought I'd read a little bit of. Mm-hmm. This one's called The High Divide. And it's about a boy living in a... it's a home that has a school also. I don't know if it's orphans that live there. It doesn't clarify, but he just refers to it as the home. At the home, I'd get up early when the sisters were still asleep and head to the ancient Chinese man's store. The ancient Chinese man was a brown, knotted, shriveled man who looked like a chunk of ginger root and ran one of those tiny stores that sells grapefruits, wine, and toilet paper. And no one can ever figure out how they survive. But he survived. He figured it out. His ancient Chinese wife was a little twig of a woman who sat in a chair and never said a word. He spoke only enough English to conduct business, to say hello and goodbye, to make change, although every morning when I came for my grapefruit, I tried to teach him some useful vocabulary. I came out of the gray drizzle through the glass door with the old fishback appliance repair sign still stenciled on it, a copper cowbell clanging above me, and the store was cold, the lights weren't even on. I went to the bin and picked through the grapefruits and found one that wasn't bad, a yellow ball, soft and square from sitting too long in the box. And then I went to the counter. The Chinese man wasn't there. His tiny branch-like wife was sitting in her chair all bent up. I searched my pockets for show, knowing all along that I'd be a little short. I came up with 27 cents, half a paper clip, a pen cap, and a ball of blue lint. I put the money in her hand, and she stared at it. By the lonesome sound my nickels and pennies made when she sorted them into their slots, I also knew that the till was empty. I looked behind her through the beaded curtain to the small apartment behind the shop. Next to the kitchen sink was an apple with a bite out of it. The bite turned brown like an old laugh. I held my grapefruit, tossed it up in the air, caught it. "Where is he?" I asked. She was chewing on a slice of ginger and offered me a piece, which I accepted. In the morning, they chewed ginger instead of drinking coffee. "Husband?" I said. She blinked and spat on the floor. So that's just a little fragment in this boy's life in the home. And like I said, it just takes you in to what's going on in that scene. It's so beautifully written.
Yeah, right. Really, and this is a collection of stories.
This is a collection, the Dead Fish Museum.
All right. We're, I think, coming down to about to the point where we usually would like to take a break. And before going on, and we'll give Stephen Lyons another turn, let me introduce again the guest, Kelly Strom. She's the collection manager at the Champaign Public Library. And Stephen Lyons, he's a writer and a book reviewer, and his reviews have appeared in, as I've mentioned, a number of places, the Chicago Sun-Times and Tribune, San Francisco Chronicle, other papers as well. And what we're doing here, this is a show that we started doing a long, long time ago, and we discovered it was a lot of fun, and people, listeners, said that they enjoyed it, where we have guests come in, and we say, you know, tell us about what you have read lately, or maybe it's just a book that you have come across that you think that people will enjoy. Just, you know, share that with us. We can share that with the listeners. And I know, based on these programs, I've gotten good recommendations for reading, and people have told me the same. So that's kind of the idea. And as well as having the recommendations from Stephen and Kelly, if you would like to call in, if you're listening, you'd like to call in and give us one, you can do that too. So it's 333-9455, like always, here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. We also want to remind people that this is the last day of our fall pledge drive. We've shortened these up so that we just don't spend as much time on the air asking for money. We're happy about that. We expect that you are too, but we still need to raise the same amount of money. Actually, every time we do this, we need to raise more. We've set this goal for this drive of $200,000, and I'm sure at some point here we can get an update to find out how we're doing. We've just cut it down to what is the bare minimum that we need to raise the money. There would have been a time when we would have been going all week, but this is the last day. So that makes it very important that if you haven't made a contribution, that we hear from you right now. Why don't you give us a call, 244-9455. That's a number to pledge. We do also have a toll-free line, 866-779-9455. And if it would be a long-distance call, use that one. Make a contribution. Help us meet the challenge that we're about to talk about, I'm sure. And also, we have many books that need homes. And you can help us that way, too. And in the process, get yourself a book. Jack Brighton is here with me, too.
That's right. We have far too many books. Please help us out and make a pledge. 244-9455 is the pledge line. Let's check in with producer Martha Deal and get an update on where things stand. And so, Martha, what's going on?
We are at $179,889, edging up closer, get to that goal that we want to get to. And we're asking listeners to call with a contribution, 244-9455, toll-free, 866-779-9455, and pledge your support for local radio. I mean, I think the point that we're losing reviewers for books is a really important thing, and that's something you get here at WILL. You get the local program. You get to talk to the author of that book when you call. You don't get to have somebody else ask your questions, although David asks wonderful questions. You get to ask a question of the author, and I think that is just one of the coolest things on the planet. So please pick up the phone, call 244-9455 or toll-free 866-779-9455 or go online, willpledge.org.
Now, we know a lot of people wait until this last day on Focus 580 to pledge because they know we're going to give them books. I mean, there are no dummies out there. People listen to this show. They know the deal. You know, so this is your chance. Now is the time. So this is the crazy Dave and Jack and Martha and Harriet book giveaway. Make your pledge call now. We'll give you either a fiction or nonfiction book. You pick the category. We can't list all the titles because there's too darn many of them. But they're hardcover, brand new books sent to us by major reputable publishers.
Mostly.
Yes.
Yeah, mostly.
And some excellent books. So with your pledge of $40 or more, a free book, 244-9455, toll-free, 866-779-9455, or go online to willpledge.org.
Yeah, I'm sure this is not the only program that you listen to on WILL. I'm confident that people who are listening to us now also listen to Afternoon Magazine and Morning Edition and programming on the weekend. So what you're doing is now you're not just supporting Focus 5, but you're supporting everything that we do here on WILL. And that's really important because, yes, we continue to get some money from the state of Illinois and some money from the federal government, but over time, that funding has just eroded, just bit by bit. And the only really reliable source we have of funding for the station, the money that it takes to run the place, is you. So if it's important to you, it really deserves your support. I think we've been saying, you know, people say, well, okay, maybe how much should I give? And one of the numbers that we pulled up out of the air is, how about $52? Why 52? Well, that would be a dollar a week. And so we have said to people, now, look, you listen to the station a lot, right? If we had to pay, would you pay a dollar a week to be able to listen to WILO? And I bet that a lot of people say, well, yeah, I guess I would pay a dollar a week. Well, okay, that's a $52 pledge. Maybe you could even do $2 a week or $3 a week. That's up to you. The important thing is that we can count you among this group that we call the Friends of WILL. They're the financial supporters of the station. And you can get a book in the process. That's a pretty good deal. All right.
244-9455, toll-free 866-779-9455. Those are the pledge numbers. Or go online to willpledge.org and make a real quick contribution. Just take a minute, and we thank you.
All right. We have a caller to talk with. Let's do that. We will not make them wait any longer. Somebody over in Belgium, near Danville. This is line number four. Not the country, Belgium. No, I always make that clip. This poor man is always thinking, he's thinking, yes, yes, yes. He has to make a big deal of it. Yeah, but I just want to make sure people, Belgium, there are people listening. There could be people listening in Belgium, but yes. They can't call. No, this is Belgium, Illinois. Hi there.
Hello.
Go ahead.
Okay, I'm the other guy.
This is the other, we have a total of two guys who live in Belgium. This is Belgium guy number two. And, welcome. Thanks for calling.
And yeah. I'm not the guy who's going to jail.
What's that?
I'm not the guy who's going to jail.
Oh, well, I hope none of our friends in Belgium are going to jail.
Yeah. Okay. Two writers, Corson Hirschfeld.
Uh-huh.
And, let me see, Joseph T. Kempler. Okay. One book is Shoot the Moon by Kempner, K-L-E-M-P-N-E-R.
Mm-hmm.
And Hirschfeld is Hirschfeld. But these guys kind of write like a cross between Carl Hyson and Ivanovich, Jared Ivanovich.
Mm-hmm.
They're really funny.
So these are our mystery writers or crime writers?
Yeah. Yes. Yes. And, let me see, also, Stuart. Oh, I can't think of his last name.
Stuart Woods?
I can't think of his last name. Stuart Kaminsky.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And they're good.
Okay. Well, thanks for the recommendation. I know people who like mysteries, you end up, I'm sure, finding one author that you like. Mm-hmm. You just plow through it and read everything that that person has ever read, and then you're hungry for more, so you want to go and find something else.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And that's how I come across... these other writers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's great.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
All right. Well, I appreciate the suggestion. Other people who are listening, if there's somebody that you'd like to recommend, a writer you'd like to recommend, you give us a call. Or I suppose occasionally what we've done on the show is we've said maybe there's a particular book that you're – a particular kind of book that you're looking for. As a challenge to our guests, we'd said you can call and say, look, I'm looking for a book that's like this. Do you know anything that would fit that? And on every once in a while, I think the guests have said, "Oh yes, I can give you one for that." So we'll play that game and we'll see how we do. 333-9455. toll free 800-222-9455. Here's the other guy who lives in Belgium. And line number one, hi there.
Yes, I'm not going to jail.
I was hoping, I was really worried, you know. I'm thinking, man, I would hope not.
But I do have a book to throw up, and it's a rather old book, and it's really about what I do. It's written by James Cranoff, who's a rather well-known cabinet maker, and it's called A Cabinet Maker's Notebook. And now you would think, well, this might be just a little bit too much just about a topic that one person's interested in. But he really has a nice way to describe how to put together a piece of furniture. And he really does a great job of giving you insight into wanting to do your job with the best of your abilities.
Hmm.
And you can find it in a library every place. It's a rather old book, probably 10, 15 years old.
And but, now this is so if you really were somebody who built furniture, you could actually learn something about how to do it from that book?
Well, the topic he really talks about a lot is how to blend the art of woodworking with the material you have.
Hmm.
In other words, you compose with the grain of the wood and the color of the wood and add that to your project just as much as designing a cabinet in whatever style you may want. I'm not a writer, so I really can't put it eloquently as he did, but he does a very good job on this. And if you are a cabinet maker, yes, you would get some insights out of it. But if you're not, you'd get an insight out of what the right way to live is. You know what I mean?
Okay, so it's not a how-to book as much as it's a
philosophy.
A philosophy book. Okay, great.
Yes, sir.
Great.
Take care.
All right, thank you.
In a similar vein, David, I wanted to mention to our freedman in Belgium that there's another book that came out 1 or 2 years ago called Clapton's Guitar, and it's one that kind of flew under the radar screen. It's by Alan St. John, a journalist, I think from the Washington, D.C. area. Eric Clapton was in a studio, and he picked up an acoustic guitar and started noodling on it and said, "What is this? I've never had a tone like this in my life." And it turned out to be, I don't know if you want to say obscure, but a guitar maker in a small town, I believe in West Virginia, who just makes 2 or 3 guitars a year. And I can't think of the name of the guitar maker, the guitar brand. And so the journalist follows the guitar maker making these 2 custom guitars for Eric Clapton.
Wow.
And it's just a wonderful... I was thinking of this with the cabinet maker, the idea of craftsmanship, and also, like the caller said, a way to live, a philosophy of a way to live. And in this case, the guitar maker lived a very stripped-down way of living. He chose to live very simply and built his guitars when he wanted and was an expert fingerstyle guitar player himself.
Uh-huh. Now, apparently, the man's name is Wayne Henderson.
That's right. It's a Henderson guitar.
Yeah.
And they're just if Eric Clapton says they're good, then they must be.
I would
good.
Think so. Yeah. Yes. If it gets his seal approval, yeah. I'm going with that. Well, that sounds great. It would be the kind of thing that if you maybe there's somebody in your family, someone who is close to you who is a guitarist and likes to play, that might make a nice thing for you to look for them. Very good. Mm-hmm. All right. That's Clapton's Guitar, Watching Wayne Henderson Build the Perfect Instrument by Alan St. John, and it looks like it is now in its paperback. It came out a couple of years ago. Very good. Well, Kelly, tell us about another book.
Well, I think I'm going to change veins here a little bit, and I'm going to pull another fiction one. This one is scary.
Good time
Halloween's
for that.
Coming up.
Yeah.
So I wanted to bring something scary. This is by a well-known author who writes terror fiction. His name is John Ferris, and it's called You Don't Scare Me. And bear with me now. It's about a girl, and she's, I think, 14 when the story begins. Her name is Chase Emmerich, and her mother meets this guy, and they start dating and eventually get married, and the guy is just creepy, absolutely creepy. And a lot of things happen, bad things, in their family life, and he ends up pretty much haunting her whole life. She becomes this really brilliant mathematician, and he continues to haunt her whole life, and it's just... It really draws you in. Like, I did not want to put it down when I read it, and there is a surprise ending which is always fun as well. But I did want to read a little bit about how this one begins. It says, "For the first time, Mama brought Crow Tillman," that's the guy's name, mm-hmm. Crow Tillman, "around to the house about 3 weeks after she'd met him. It was clear she was already head over heels. He hugged her a lot and gave her little kisses that had her simpering and said how glad he was to finally meet us. Us being me and my brother Jimmy. This was October, and about 3 years to the day they'd put Daddy in the ground. I didn't know what to think of Crow Tillman at first. Didn't much care for his name, that was for sure. Crow. Wasn't sure for anything, or if it was, he never said. That's the name that went on their marriage license later, too. Too soon to suit Jimmy and me. Anyway, he was tall, maybe 6'2", raven hair that he wore like an Indian's, combed straight back and down over his shirt collar. Thick enough that he didn't have to gel or spray it. Said he had Choctaw blood. No reason to doubt him. He was plenty good-looking. The black eye patch didn't detract from his looks. He was lean and looked strong, a sharp dresser except for a ratty Richard Petty-style rancher straw with a couple of kitchen matches stuck in the band. He wore starched, pressed Wranglers and rattlesnake skin boots. And there were little gold chains across the insteps. He wore gold chains around his neck and three gold rings. Only one tat, unless there were others in places I'd never see. But that tattoo was scary. What happened to your eye? I asked him right off. Mama just took a deep breath and held it. But I'd always spoke exactly what was on my mind, and at 14 I wasn't about to change. Lost it when I was riding bulls in the PBR, Crow said. Did I say he smiled a lot? Too much, I was thinking. People who smiled all the time, in my estimation, didn't have a lot of humor in them. As we all learned later, that went double for Crow. And as I heard later, he was never a bull rider. It was the point of a Bowie knife in a bar fight that took out his eye. And that's the way we learned about Crow. Too late to save any of us. Bits and pieces, rumors vague and rumors far-fetched. But they were all Jimmy and me had to go on. He wasn't forthcoming about any aspect of his life.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of sets the stage and some of the characterization of what's going on in the story. So, yeah, it's scary. But it's, but it's you know, fun to read this time of year.
So, well, I'm sure that librarians, I'm sure that you, depending on the time of the year, you set up, you pull out certain kinds of books just to see if people get jazzed by the things and have them out and say, you know, here, this is the time of year we're getting near Halloween. Maybe you'd like to read something sort of macabre and you put out those books. Does demand really go like that? Or is that just you're trying to find some way to just get people, you know, excited and take out a book?
A little bit of both, I think. You know, we try to set up different kinds of displays every day just to entice the people that come in. Like today, I noticed when I was in this morning, they had a big display set up on knitting books because, you know, it's also that time of year when you're thinking about warmer clothing and knitting projects indoors. And so it's not just, you know, fiction. It's any aspect of the books at the library. There's different times of year when they definitely go out more than others. And I think this time of year, yeah, you see a lot of scary books going out.
Yeah. Okay.
I know
I've
bought many home myself for the kids and the husband.
And is this a book for grown-up readers?
Yes.
This is not a
let's just clarify
kind of thing.
Adult,
okay.
R-rated.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. Very good.
Yeah.
Well, Stephen, give us another one.
Well, I have one that's coming out January 1st of next year that I just finished reading. I'm reviewing it for the Sun-Times. It goes along really with this whole, what I call a golden age of narrative journalism, which we're in. Nobody's pinpointed it yet, but I'm going to pinpoint it today on your show during Pledge Week. This is a golden age of narrative journalism. What I mean by that is telling a nonfiction story using storytelling techniques of fiction writers. Specifically, short story is a good example of that because the form tends to be short in newspapers and magazines. But in this one, this is a book form. This is called Damned to Eternity, the story of the man who, they say, caused the flood. The flood being the flood of 1993 that we all remember on the Mississippi. Mm-hmm. This is an Illinois book because the fellow who was charged with this crime is from Quincy, Illinois, over there on the Mississippi River. And I'll just read you the back copy of what it's about. James Scott was 24 years old when he was first convicted in 1994 and then again in 1998 on appeal of intentionally causing a catastrophe. His alleged crime was causing a levee to break, which flooded over 14,000 acres of farmland during the great Midwestern floods of 93. Though no one died, he was the first and only, and still is, the only person in Missouri history convicted under an obscure 1979 law and is now serving a life sentence. He won't be eligible for his first parole hearing until 2023. He'll be 55 years old at the time. In Damned to Eternity, the author Adam Pitluck, P-I-T-L-U-K, contends that James Scott was a victim of a federal agency, a town, and law enforcement hell-bent on blaming him for something he maintains he didn't do. This is a very fascinating book because James Scott is not a likable character at all. It's hard to have sympathy for him. He's a lifetime hood, if you want to, for a better term, convicted of arson fires, him and his other brothers, actually. Somebody that would drink a 12-pack of beer every day, and he wasn't going to win the Nobel Prize. Let's put it that way. You know, in this week of Nobels, he was not going to be. But did he really cause this flood? He was a volunteer at the time. He claims he noticed that the levee was being breached. All the levees were breached on the river, too, by the way. And this one probably in West Quincy would have been breached eventually. But he moved some sandbags, he claims, to cover up this water that was starting to come in, and then went to get help. And so he was basically convicted on circumstantial evidence. There's nobody that actually witnessed him doing this. But they were anxious to convict somebody of this crime, to assign blame, if you will.
Yeah.
But whether he did it or not, the author is skilled enough. It's just vague. It's vague enough. But it's very hard to have sympathy for somebody, and it's much harder when you've committed many crimes in the past to test your case, to plead your case.
Yeah.
So it's a fascinating book. It's about the criminal justice system, a lot about floods, what causes floods, and Quincy, basically, about Quincy as well.
Yeah.
So I recommend it. It comes out January 1st.
Well, it's sort of a novel idea that something we would think of as tend to talk about as an act of God,
mm-hmm.
that the idea would be that we could actually find a person, one individual person.
Yes.
And say, this incredible act of nature that caused all this discretion was your fault, this one guy. And that we would the idea that you could pin it on one person like that seems a little irrational, maybe.
And, you know, he's defended by public defenders. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but this is not like the super team that O.J. had or some celebrity would have of lawyers that would come in from across the country defending him.
Yeah.
So, and he's limited in his own intellect, I think, in his own knowledge.
Okay. And this is going to be coming out at the beginning of the year.
January 1st, 2008, from DeCapo Press, which publishes a lot of fascinating books. We can't really underestimate the quality of publishing in the country. Obviously, Random House controls many of the imprints, but there are a lot of smaller presses that do a tremendous job, especially university presses and smaller presses that just publish a few books a year.
Yeah, and certainly I'm sure that it's also true that with fiction that there are novels that fortunately are published that the publishers know are not going to sell a million.
Oh, yeah.
Copies, you know. But that there are people who are willing to publish them if they think that they can sell, I don't know, 5,000, maybe. And I'm sure that author would be very happy to be able to sell, you know, 5,000 books or 10,000 books or
even 500,
you know,
sometimes in the real small publishers.
So that's what we have to give it up for the fact that there are still people willing to publish books because they think that they're good books,
mm-hmm.
and that they would like to have people read them, and not because they think that they're going to make millions and millions of dollars. We're kind of coming down to about our last 3-4 minutes here. Stephen Lyons is a book reviewer and a writer, and Kelly Strom is the collection manager of the Champaign Public Library. And they're here just talking with us about books. People who are listening can do the same. And the second hour will continue this same theme, but we'll have another two guests. So we'll get as much variety in here as possible. Kelly, you want to go? We'll do at least one more. Maybe we'll do another round.
Just real quick ones. A couple others I brought. There's a book called Ravel, a novel, by Jean Echenoz. That's E-C-H-E-N-O-Z, translated from the French by Linda Coverdale. And basically, it's a story about the great composer Ravel in the last 5 years of his life, but it's fictionalized.
Mm-hmm.
So they're taking some fact of what went on, and then they're just, of course, embellishing that. And this was a really different book because it was very detail-oriented, like down to just his natty appearance, what he wore, how he liked different, you know, the exact temperature of his coffee, or And it was just really interesting to me because I didn't know too much about that composer. So that would be a quickie for that. And then I was just talking to Stephen earlier. He just bought this book, The Florist's Daughter, for your
mother. My mother-in-law is reading it right now. I loaned it to her.
This is a memoir by Patricia Hempel, and it's a beautifully written story that starts off, the author is writing her mother's obituary with one hand as she's holding her hand in the hospital bed with the other. Hmm. And basically it's her memoirs of growing up with her mom and dad. So it's a very beautifully written, lovely story.
Okay. Stephen, you want to?
A book that's reminded me a lot of Devil in the White City, which, mm-hmm. of course, had huge success about a serial murder and the Columbian Exposition going on in Chicago at the time, is called The Strange Case of Hellish Nell, the story of Helen Duncan and the witch trial of World War II. This is a woman who was, during this whole period of time, was doing seances in England, and she started giving away ship and troop positions for the British. And Churchill got a hold of this and some other people, and they said, we have to do something about this. This woman who's right on about these ship movements and various things during the war. So they had to figure out a way to bring her in, rein her in. So they tried her under the country's Witchcraft Act of 1735.
This was happening during World War II,
right.
Wow.
But they were using a law from
1735. Why not? You know, they could find them, I guess. So it's a fast-paced, a fun piece of, I guess you'd call narrative history, and highly recommended. It's, again, one that kind of flew under the radar screen. I guess I say that. There's just probably not, again, there's this need for book reviews, mm-hmm. So we know about these books.
Yeah. How many, would you guess, Kelly, how many books are published every year?
I thought it was about 187,000 last year, but I may be mistaken on that.
I just call it a gazillion.
Yeah, it's really staggering. Well, and we're a very short, very small operation here, but I'll bet every day here we must get six,
really?
Eight, probably. Mm-hmm. Yeah, on an average day, I'm sure that we do. And a lot of them are, you know, they're not all really, really good, but a lot of them are very interesting. And you look at them and think, well, you know, that could well be an interesting book. I mean, it really, when people talk about how no one's reading anymore, I go into the bookstore and there are people in it and there are books and there are people in the library.
Our circulation goes up and up every single year. It's crazy. And I buy about 200 titles a week.
Wow.
And our circulation's explosive. Explosive. So no, you can't tell me people are not reading.
Yeah, okay. Well, we got somebody who's reading here. Somebody in Rantoul who wants to talk with us. Let's do that. Our line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I would like to recommend very highly a book that I got a long time ago. It only comes in soft color. Soft cover. The title is Letters to the Editor, 200 Years in the Life of an American Town. And it is written by by reporters from the local newspaper, Jared Stropnicki, Tom Byrne, James Good, ending with an E, and Jerry Matheny. This is my own, and this happens to be my own hometown in Bloomsburg, Pennsylvania, where there happens to be a university. But this consists of letters to the editor, the Bloomsburg Press. 200 years in the life, and it starts out with letters, and they are, some of them are highly amusing, some of them are of course very serious, some of them is political, but this started out as the reporters were very interested in the letters, and this started out as a play. They wrote a play around these 200 years of letters. It actually went off-Broadway, and then someone in the publishing business said, hey, this would make a great book, and it does, and I recommend it highly. I want to read the second letter. It says, now, the university there started out as what they used to call a normal school, mm-hmm. a college just for teachers. This is from a farmer. The business has bloomed to be continually growing and increasing and want to lay out more lots and build more houses and open more streets and alleys. I think I lost it. Some people think the more the town increases in population and size and beauty and schools and churches, the better it is for the whole county, and I don't see it. You say you're going to get a normal school in Bloomsburg, and that will bring about 500 more people there to help eat up bread and meat and potatoes and butter, et cetera. And if we have to keep you all in provisions, I don't know what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. Signed, A Countryman, May 8, 1868. And that's one of the ways that it begins. And it, as I said, it's sometimes hilarious. It's sometimes very serious. But I, as you can tell, this is a terrific book at any rate.
All right. Well, thanks very much. It's Letters to the Editor, 200 Years in the Life of an American Town.
That's correct.
Is that right? And it was published in 1998.
Yeah,
but it's still.
Am I assuming that you know about this book?
I'm just looking. I'm on Amazon on their webpage, and I just called it up just so make sure we can do that. So actually, it was this is it, Kelly. I showed her another one have here, and I think it was a different book. So because Kelly now is writing these things down, so some of these books that have been discussed here might appear in the Champaign Public Library.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, thank you very much for calling that in.
Okay.
We're at the point here where we're going to have to close out this hour of the show. If you'd like to get the information on the books that Stephen and Kelly have recommended, go to our website, which is will.illinois.edu, and it'll be there.